Chapter 7. Hippopotamus and Crocodile. Guided by Rabah, the party now descended to the edge of the swamp. Here in the shallow water lay three rafts, constructed of bundles of bulrushes. They were turned up in front so as to form a sort of swan-necked bow. Upon each stood a native with a pole for pushing the rafts along, and three or four spears. These were of unusual shape. They had broad, short blades, and these were loosely attached to the shafts, so that when the animal was struck, the shaft would drop out, leaving the head embedded in its flesh. To the head was attached a cord, which was wound up on a spindle passing through a handle. "Those rafts do not look as if they would carry three," Kebron said.
"They will do so at a push," the man replied, "but they are better with two only."
"I will stop on shore with your permission, Kebron," Jethro said. "I see there are a number of men here with ropes. I suppose they have something to do with the business, and I will accompany them."
"The ropes are for hauling the beasts ashore after we have struck them."
"Well, I will go and help them then."
"We have been out this morning, my lord," the boatman said, addressing Kebron, "and have found that there is a river horse lying in a pool a mile up the river. I think he is a large one, and will give you good sport."
Kebron and Amuba now took their places on the two rafts, and the men, taking the poles, pushed off from the shore. Noiselessly they made their way among the rushes. Not a word was spoken, as the men had warned them that the slightest noise would scare the hippopotami and cause them to sink to the bottom of the pools, where they would be difficult to capture. After half an hour's poling, they reached a pool larger than any that they had hitherto passed. The man on his raft now signed to Kebron to take up one of the spears, but the lad shook his head and motioned to him to undertake the attack. The man nodded, for he had indeed been doubting as to the course which the affair would take, for it needed a thrust with a very powerful arm to drive the spear through the thick hide of the hippopotamus. Amuba imitated Kebron's example, preferring to be a spectator instead of an actor in the unknown sport. For 3 or 4 minutes the boats lay motionless. Then a blowing sound was heard, and the boatmen pointed to what seemed to the boys 2 lumps of black mud projecting an inch or two above the water near the margin of the rushes. With a noiseless push, Kebron's hunter sent the boat in that direction, and then handed the end of the pole to Kebron, signing to him to push the boat back when he gave the signal. When within 10 yards of the 2 little black patches, there was a sudden movement. They widened into an enormous head. The huge beast rose to his feet, startled at the discovery he had just made that men were close at hand. In an instant the hunter hurled his spear with all his force. Tough as was the animal's hide, the sharp head cut its way through. With a roar, the beast plunged into the rushes, the shaft of the spear falling out of its socket as it did so, and the strong cord ran out rapidly from the reel held by the hunter. Presently the strain ceased.
"He has laid down again in shelter," the hunter said. "We will now follow him and give him a second spear."
Pushing the rushes aside, the boat was forced along until they again caught sight of the hippopotamus. Another spear was thrown with good effect. There was a roar and a great splash, and the animal turned off and dashed back to the pool where he had been first lying. The boat again followed the hippopotamus. Amuba was still on his raft on the pool.
"What has become of him?"
Kebron asked as they passed beyond the rushes. "He has sunk to the bottom of the pool," Amuba replied. "He gave me a start, I can tell you. We heard him bursting through the rushes, and then he rushed out with his mouth open, a mouth like a cavern. And then, just as I thought he was going to charge us, he turned off and sank to the bottom of the pool."
"How long will he lie there?" Kebron asked the hunter. "A long time if he is left to himself, but we are going to stir him up."
So saying, he directed the boat towards the rushes nearest to the bank and pushed the boat through them.
"Oh, here you are, Jethro," Kebron said, seeing the Rebu and the men he had accompanied standing on the bank.
The hunter handed the cords to the men and told them to pull steadily, but not hard enough to break the cords. Then he took from them the end of the rope they carried and pulled back into the pool.
"Those cords are not strong enough to pull the great beast to the shore, are they?"
Cabron asked.
"Oh, no, they would not move him, but he gets uneasy and rises to the surface in anger. Then, you see, I throw this noose over his head, and they can pull upon that."
In 2 or 3 minutes the animal's head appeared above the water. The instant it did so, the hunter threw the noose, and with a jerk he tightened it round the neck.
"Now, pull!"
he shouted. The peasants pulled, and gradually the hippopotamus was drawn towards the bank. As soon, however, as he reached the shallow water and his feet touched the ground, he threw his whole weight upon the rope. The peasants were thrown to the ground, and the rope dragged through their fingers as the hippopotamus again made his way to the bottom of the pool. The peasants regained their feet and again pulled on the cords and rope. Again the hippopotamus rose and was dragged to the shallows, only to break away again. 8 or 10 times this happened.
"He is getting tired now," the hunter said. "Next time, or the time after, they will get him on shore. We will land then and attack him with spears and arrows."
The hippopotamus was indeed exhausted, and allowed itself to be dragged ashore at the next effort without opposition. As soon as it did so, he was attacked with spears by the hunters, Jethro, and the boys. The hippopotamus sank on its knees and rolled over dead. The peasants sent up a shout of joy, for the flesh of the hippopotamus is by no means bad eating, and here was a store of food sufficient for the whole neighborhood.
"What is that?" Amuba exclaimed suddenly, as a loud scream was heard at a short distance away. "It's a woman's voice!"
Kebron darted off in full speed in the direction of the sound, closely followed by Amuba and Jethro. They ran about 100 yards along the bank, where they saw an immense crocodile making his way towards the river, dragging along with it the figure of a woman. In spite of his reverence for the crocodile, Kebron did not hesitate a moment, but rushing forward smote the crocodile on the nose with all his strength with the shaft of his spear. The crocodile dropped its victim and turned upon its assailant, but Jethro and Amuba were close behind and also attacked him. The crocodile, seeing the succession of enemies, now set out for the river, snapping its jaws together.
"Mind its tail!"
one of the hunters exclaimed, running up. But the warning was too late, for the next moment Amuba received a tremendous blow which sent him to the ground. The hunter at the same moment plunged his spear into the animal. Jethro followed his example on the other side. The animal checked its flight, and turning round and round, lashed with its tail in all directions.
"Keep clear of it," the hunter shouted. "It is mortally wounded."
In fact, the crocodile had received its death wound. Its movements became more languid. It ceased to lash its tail, though it still snapped at those nearest to it. But gradually, this action also ceased. Its head sank, and it was dead. Jethro, as soon as he had delivered his blow, ran to Amuba.
"Are you hurt?"
he asked anxiously.
"No, I don't think so," Amuba gasped. "The brute has knocked all the breath out of my body. But that's better than if he'd hit me in the leg, for I think he would have broken it had he done so."
They now walked across to Kebron, who was stooping over the figure of the crocodile's victim.
"Why, she is but a girl," Amuba exclaimed. "She's no older than your sister, Kebron."
"Do you think she is dead?"
Kebron asked.
"I think she has only fainted," Jethro replied. "Here," he shouted to one of the peasants who were gathered round the crocodile, "one of you run down to the water and bring up a gourdful."
He sprang up to the top of some rising ground and looked around. "There is a cottage close at hand," he said as he returned. He lifted up the slight figure and carried her up the slope, the two lads following. On turning round the foot of a sand hill, they saw a cottage lying nestled behind it. The walls of baked clay had been whitewashed and were half covered with bright flowers. A patch of carefully cultivated ground lay around it. Jethro entered the cottage. On a settle at the further end a man was sitting. He was apparently of great age. His hair and long beard were snowy white.
"What is it?"
he exclaimed as Jethro entered.
I heard Ruth's cry, but my limbs have lost their powers, and I could not rise to come to her aid.
I trust that the child is not severely injured, Jethro said. We had just killed a hippopotamus when we heard her scream, and running up found a great crocodile dragging her to the river, but we soon made him drop her. Ah, here's the water.
Who are those to whom I owe the life of my grandchild?
The old man asked.
I am Kebron, the son of Ameres, high priest of the temple of Osiris at Thebes. These are my friends, Amuba and Jethro, two of the Rebu nation who were brought to Egypt and now live in my father's household.
We are his servants, Amuba said, though he is good enough to call us his friends.
'Tis strange, the old man said, that the son of a priest of Osiris should thus come to gladden the last few hours of one who has always withstood the Egyptian gods. And yet, had the crocodile carried off my Ruth, it might have been better for her, seeing that ere the sun has risen and set many times, she will be alone in the world.
The girl uttered a little cry, and rising on her knees threw her arms around the old man's neck.
It must be so, my Ruth. I have lived 110 years, and my course is run. But she trusts in the God of Abraham, he said to Kebron, and he will raise up a protector for her.
You are an Israelite, Kebron said. How is it that you are not dwelling among your people, instead of alone among strangers?
I left them 30 years back when Ruth's mother was but a child. They would not suffer me to dwell in peace among them, but drove me out because I testified against them. My father was already an old man when I was born, and he was one of the few who still clung to the faith of our fathers. He taught me that there was but one God, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, and that all other gods were but images of wood or stone. To that faith I clung, though after a while few of our people held to the belief. The others had forgotten their God and worshipped the gods of the Egyptians. When I would speak to them, they treated my words as ravings and as casting dishonor on the gods they served. My sons went with the rest, but my daughter learned the true faith from my lips and clung to it. She taught her daughter after her. And 10 years ago, when she lay dying, she sent Ruth to me, praying me to bring her up in the faith of our fathers. So for 10 years we have dwelt here together, tilling and watering our ground and living on its fruit, and by the sale of baskets that we weave and exchange for fish with our neighbors. But my hours are numbered. And I see no way after me but that Ruth shall return to our people, who will assuredly in time wean her from her faith.
Never, grandfather, the girl said firmly. I will never deny my God.
All matters are in the hands of God, who will again reveal himself in his due time to his people who have forgotten him.
Amuba, looking at the girl, thought that she had more power of resistance than the old man gave her credit for. There was silence a moment, and then Kebron said, almost timidly,
"My father is wise and learned, and he knows of your religion. For I have heard him say that when they first came into this land, the Israelites worshipped one God only. I have a sister who is about the same age as Ruth, and is gentle and kind. I am sure that if I ask my father, he will take your grandchild into his household to be a friend and companion to Maissa, and I am certain that he would never try to shake her religion, but would let her worship as she chooses.
The old man looked fixedly at Kebron.
Your speech is pleasant and kind, young sir, and your voice has an honest ring. I have always prayed and believed that God would raise up protectors for Ruth, and it seems to me now that the way you have been brought hither is the answer to my prayer. Ruth, my child, you have heard the offer, and it is for you to decide. Will you go with this young Egyptian lord and serve his sister as a handmaiden, or will you return to the villages of our people?"
Ruth had risen to her feet now and was looking earnestly at Cabron. Then her eyes turned to the faces of Amuba and Jethro, and then slowly went back again to Cabron.
"I believe that God has chosen for me," she said at last, "and has sent them here not only to save my life, but to be protectors to me. Their faces are all honest and good. If the father of this youth will receive me, I will, when you leave me, go and be the handmaid of his daughter."
"It is well. Now I am ready to depart, for my prayers have been heard. May God deal with you and yours, Egyptian, even as you deal with my child."
"May it be so," Cabron replied reverently. "And now we will leave you. Doubtless the excitement has wearied you, and Ruth needs rest and quiet after her fright. We will come and see you tomorrow."
Not a word was spoken for some time after they left the house, and then Cabron said,
"It really would almost seem as if what that old man said was true, and that his God had sent us there, that a protector might be found for his daughter.
It was certainly strange that we should happen to be within sound of her voice when she was seized by that crocodile, and be able to rescue her just in time."
"It is certainly strange," Amuba said. "You do not think that your father will have any objection to taking her?"
"Oh, no. I am sure that when he sees her, he will be pleased to have such a companion for Maissa. I will write him a letter telling him all about it, and send off one of the slaves with it at once." At dinner, Amuba asked Cabron whether he had decided what they should do the next day.
"It will suit me very well to have a quiet day, Cabron. My ribs are sore from the whack the crocodile gave me with his tail, and I doubt whether I shall be able to walk tomorrow."
Indeed, the next morning Amuba was so stiff and sore that he was unable to rise from his couch. Soon after breakfast the messenger returned, bringing a letter from Ameres.
"My father has consented," Cabron said joyously as he finished the letter. "I felt that he would. I will go off and tell the old man at once."
Cabron went off to the cottage. Ruth was in the garden tending the vegetables, and he stopped to speak to her before entering.
"I have not heard yet," he said, "how it came about that you were seized by the crocodile." "I hardly know how it was," she said. "I am in the habit of going down many times a day to fetch up water for the garden, and I always keep a lookout for these creatures before I fill my jar. But yesterday I had just gone round the corner of the sandhill when I was struck down with a tremendous blow, and a moment afterwards the creature seized me. I gave a scream, but I thought I was lost, for there are no neighbors within sound of my voice, and my grandfather has not been able to walk for months. Then I prayed as well as I could through the pain, and God heard me and sent you to deliver me."
"I see you walk very lame still."
"Yes. Grandfather would have me keep still for a day or two, but I think that as soon as the bruises die out and the pain ceases, I shall be as well as ever. Besides, what would the garden do without water? My grandfather will be glad to see you, my lord, but he is rather more feeble than usual this morning. The excitement of yesterday has shaken him."
She led the way into the cottage. "Your granddaughter has told me you are not very strong today," Cabron began.
"At my age," the old man said, "even a little thing upsets one, and the affair of yesterday was no little thing."
"I have satisfactory news to give you," Cabron said. "I yesterday dispatched a message to my father and have just received the answer." And taking out the scroll, he read aloud the portion in which Ameres stated his readiness to receive Ruth in his household and his promise that no pressure whatever should be put upon her to abandon her religion.
"God be praised," the old man exclaimed. "The very animals are the instruments of his will. And the crocodile that threatened death was in truth the answer sent to my prayer. Oh, I thank you, my young lord.
She may stay on with me for the little time that remains, may she not?
Surely. We should not think of taking her now. My father sends instructions as to what she is to do, and money to pay for her journey up the Nile to Thebes. And now, let me read to you what my father says about your religion. He is ever a searcher after truth, and would fain that I should hear from your lips and repeat to him all that you can tell me relating to this God whom you worship.
The story is easily told, for it is simple, and not like that of your religion, with its many deities.
Cabron took a seat upon a pile of rushes and prepared to listen to the old man's story of the God of the Israelites.